We're still interviewing poor Moses and what a life he's had and what a journey he's been on. It's not all about the children of Israel, although it has been about that. It's very much been a personal journey for Moses too. And we've been thinking about if we were possibly ever able to have an opportunity to sit down with Moses and say, Moses, what was it like? And we maybe would ask him, what was it like to get a glimpse of the glory of God? That's a wonderful, wonderful experience that he had, and we would love to know what that was like. What was it like to launch a new program, something God had revealed to him, and he had undertaken to be part of that, and he had set it in motion, and then, bang, he was just met with a whole series of distractions. What was it like then, Moses, to see past those distractions? And then worse was to happen. Moses, what was it like to handle rebellion? And then in their last study, Moses, what was it like to fail? That was the story, of course, of Moses striking the rock twice. So today we're going to look at yet another possible question we would ask Moses if we could, and it is this. Moses, what was it like to have a door close on you? Now, not meaning somebody shutting a door in your hand or something like that. You know the idea of what I'm talking about. Doors of opportunity and something closing on you. We're going to read back in the book of Numbers and chapter 20, and this time we'll read a couple of verses from verse 14. Numbers 20 and verse 14. And Moses sent messengers from Kadesh unto the king of Edom. Thus saith thy brother Israel, thou knowest all the travail or all the difficulties that have befallen us. How our fathers went down into Egypt, and we have dwelt in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians vexed us and our fathers. And when we cried unto the Lord, he heard our voice, sent an angel, and hath brought us forth out of Egypt. And behold, we are in Kadesh, a city in the uttermost of thy border. So Moses writes, or sends a message, or gets a message somehow to the king of Edom. Who were they? Who were the Edomites? What's significant about them? Well, way back in Genesis 36 and verse 8, we read about a character you'll know. Thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. So in other words, that verse is telling us that the Edomites were descendants of Esau, who was the twin brother of Jacob, and Jacob had his name changed to Israel and became the head of the people, of course, we refer to as Israel. And that's why in that little statement of a message that Moses sent, he says, thus saith thy brother Israel. And he's taking the king of Edom back to the relationship that there was between Jacob and Esau. So because of this, they were often in other places referred to with regard to their relationship. The term brother that we find used here in Numbers 20 and 14 is also used in Deuteronomy 2, Amos 1 and Obadiah 1. And Edom became a kingdom and apparently was based in the mountainous terrain south and east of the Dead Sea. But a bit like their forefathers or their founding fathers, Jacob and Esau, the two nations had a very complicated relationship. And although the blood relationship is often acknowledged as you read down through the events that surround these two groups in the narrative of the Bible, the Edomites didn't always act in a very brotherly way towards Israel. In fact, much farther on, during the Babylonian conquest of Judah and Jerusalem, the Edomites behaved so badly towards God's people that they placed themselves under his condemnation and became subject to his wrath. And in Isaiah, Ezekiel, and again Obadiah, Malachi, there are woes to Edom and pronouncements made of God's judgment upon Edom for what they would eventually do. So that's a wee bit about who they are and the significance of this. So you would think way back at this stage, when it's not so many, many generations from Jacob and Esau, that there would have been an affection. There would still have been a loyalty, let's put it that way, at the very least, between the two. And Moses appeals to the king from the position also of Israel being kind of friendless in the world. They've left Egypt all that time, at this stage, almost 40 years earlier. They have managed to survive in the wilderness, a difficult terrain by anyone's imagination. And yet they had known the help of the Lord. And Moses is making that clear in a very concise way. But they, other than that, are friendless in the world. And Moses' request is very reasonable. That which reminds me of what happened when Moses, at the very beginning, the very first time he went in before Pharaoh. Do you remember his request was so reasonable to Pharaoh? We just want to be able to go out into the desert and a wee bit of a journey and sacrifice unto our God. And of course, we know that God intended that that would be the beginning of the Exodus. But the reason why that was all the information that was given to Pharaoh was because it was a reasonable request to show how unreasonable Pharaoh would be. And here Moses comes again with a very reasonable request. And all he's really wanting to do is to pass through their land rather than to have to go a very long roundabout journey around their borders. Verse 17, let us pass, I pray thee, through thy country. We will not pass through fields or through vineyards, neither will we drink of the water of the wells. We will go by the king's highway. We will not turn to the right hand or to the left until we have passed thy borders. Now, with such a straightforward notice of their intentions and several guarantees of their neighbourly behaviour, you would think that the king of Edom would have no problem with Moses' reasonable request. But, verse 18, and Edom said unto him, and that's just representative of the response from Edom via their king or whoever, because you sometimes read also, and Israel prayed, it's representative. And Edom said unto him, thou shalt not pass by me. In fact, he goes further, lest I come out against thee with the sword. Now, in case there's some kind of misunderstanding, remember Moses, for all his faithfulness and the failure that we talked about last week, he still is regarded as a man who was meek, very meek. And in case there's some kind of understanding, Moses emphasizes his commitment to do them no harm or to leave no damage. Indeed, the Edomites would have an opportunity to profit from them if there were things that necessities. They were prepared to buy them from the people called the Edomites. Verse 19. And the children of Israel said unto him, we will go by the highway, and if I and my cattle drink of thy water, then I will pay for it. I will only, without doing any of these, go through on my feet. And he said, thou shalt not go through. And Edom came out against him with much people and with a strong hand, in other words, with a threat of force. Thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his border, wherefore Israel turned away from him. And the children of Israel, even the whole congregation, journeyed from Kadesh and came unto Mount Hor. A door closes. The Israelites under Moses had imagined that this would be an easy option for them. I'm sure in many ways it was a no-brainer. Edomites, connection with us, we tell them about what it's been like being expelled from Egypt and all, we've been alone and so on. Surely they will be friendly towards us. But the door closes. And there's, if you like, a sign here or a hint at misplaced confidence. And many times we hear it said, it's a Northern Ireland phrase anyway, you can trust nobody. But the context, of course, also of this is, it's immediately in the aftermath of Moses' failure when he did his own thing. God said one thing, Moses partly obeyed, but struck the rock twice when God said, speak to it. And then, instead of speaking to the rock, Moses spoke to the people. The very next action we read after that is this attempt to make progress into the promised land. But their plans are upset. They were depending on their relationship with the Edomites for the door to open for them. Years ago, before there were such rigorous interview techniques, when you went to look for a job, you used to say, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And I don't know if there's anybody here got the job because their uncle worked and so on in the same place. But that was the case. If you needed a start, you went somewhere where you knew somebody and that's it. And perhaps there's an idea of that in the thinking of Moses. But instead of that relationship opening doors, the door is closed. Have you ever had to deal with a door closing in your life? Has this kind of thing ever happened to you? We're asking Moses what it would be like, but maybe there's somebody here and you know what that's like. One door closing on our plans. But does that spell the end of the journey? And that's what you're going to discover from the story of Moses. It doesn't. Does a door closing on our hopes spell the end of our usefulness for him? And even this man who's an aged man, and who probably could have said at any time, Lord, I think I've nearly done enough here, I could retire any time. Does it spell the end of uselessness for Moses because this door has closed? Or does a door closing on some avenue of our thoughts or hopes or plans mean that God won't also open another door? Very interesting passage in the book of the Revelation. It's whenever Jesus is writing to the churches in Asia Minor, and he writes in chapter 3, verse 7, these words, unto the angel of the church of Philadelphia write, the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one shuts, who shuts and no one opens. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. Isn't that a wonderfully encouraging verse? Isn't that a verse maybe some of us have had to turn to at times and remember that? But it's not all about the way that we see ahead and the plans that we have. And in that context there of writing to the church at Philadelphia, I would suggest we see that the door pictures opportunity. And if that is so, then Jesus is saying that if he opens up a way of opportunity and it's of him, and no man's going to shut it. But likewise, if he bars a way that has been a choice of ours, then although we mightn't feel very good about it, he has done it for our good. And he may have to bar that way to stop us unsuccessfully going in that direction. Paul wrote to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 16 from verse 8, I will stay at Ephesus until Pentecost, for a wide door of effective work has opened for me. And he could see that this was of God, and God was doing something. And it's obvious that in writing that, he had other plans. And he's having to inform the folks at Corinth that his plan had changed. Why? Because God has opened a door. You know my story. I wouldn't be in the ministry today. Maybe some of you would be rubbing your hands and thinking, it's a pity that. But God closed a door in my life. Very, very, very definitely. But that wasn't the end. As that door closed, another door was beginning to open. And that door, of course, was into ministry. So what about you? Is there somebody here and you are pushing a door? And maybe what you're discovering is that every time you try to progress that line of thought, that path, nothing's working out. Don't despair. Because if God closes one door, he will open another. Don't just stop. Don't just give up. Don't just go back. That wasn't what Moses did. He couldn't go through Edom, but they kept on the move. And as you know, they eventually did go on with the Lord. From right through to 22, we get the idea that there was times when they would just have been absolutely shattered by this news. But yet in 22, we just read, and they journeyed from Kadesh and came to Mount Hor. So what happened there? Verse 23, and the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron in Mount Hor by the coast of the land of Edom, saying, Aaron shall be gathered unto his people. They hadn't much of an idea in the Old Testament of the afterlife compared to what we have. And we still don't know everything either. But they certainly knew that death wasn't the end, and they were going to be with the faithful who had gone on before. For he shall not enter into the land which I have given unto the children of Israel, because ye rebelled against my word at the water of Meribah. We've already looked at that, of course. Take Aaron and Eleazar his son, and bring them up unto Mount Hor. And strip Aaron of his garments, and put them on Eleazar his son, and Aaron shall be gathered unto his people, and shall die there. And Moses did as the Lord commanded, and they went up into Mount Hor in the sight of all the congregation. And Moses stripped Aaron of his garments and put them on Eleazar his son. And Aaron died there in the top of the mount. And Moses and Eleazar came down from the mount. And when all the congregation saw that Aaron was dead, they mourned for Aaron 30 days, even all the house of Israel. And even in the death of Moses' older brother Aaron, there was still a word from the Lord that the priesthood wasn't just going to end because Aaron has gone. That work was going to continue. Remember, we talked about the new program, the system, the sacrificial system, the new tabernacle. Oh, that would continue. And it was going to continue in the first instance through Eleazar, his son. You know, we sometimes think that everything revolves around us. If that's what you're thinking today, think again. Because if we were gone tomorrow, things would go on. Things would continue. Whenever we think about Moses' feelings, we don't read a great deal about them except when they maybe got angry. We've read about that. But we have one of his psalms, and Psalm 90, it's attributed to Moses. And as I looked at that psalm again, just having read about the death of his brother, it made me certainly make connections I hadn't made before. Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains brought forth or ever, thou hast formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. Thou turnest man to destruction and sayest, return ye children of men, for 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night. Thou carriest them away as with a flood. They are as asleep in the morning. They are like grass which groweth up. In the morning it flourisheth, groweth up. In the evening it is cut down and withereth. For we are consumed by thine anger, and by thy wrath are we troubled. Thou hast set our iniquities before thee, our secret sins in the light of thy countenance. For all our days are passed away in thy wrath. We spend our years as a tale that is told. The days of our years are 80 years and 10, and if by reason of strength they become 80 years, yet is their strength labour and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away. Who knoweth the power of thine anger? Even according to thy fear, so is thy wrath. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. And there's that famous little last verse there that I've read. Teach us to number our days. But before that, Moses is talking about leaving this world, but also he's thinking about God being angry and God having to see his justice through. And as we thought about some of the earlier revelations God had made to Moses, remember whenever he passed by the cleft of the rock, the Lord is his name, and how he would be merciful and gracious and all of those wonderful things. And then he says, but he will not overlook the guilty. Miriam's gone. Now Aaron has gone. And it won't be very long until Moses is gone as well. We've been asking ourselves the question, what was it like, Moses, to have a door closing you? You know what I think the hardest door for Moses to accept being closed on him was the door to the promised land itself. And now as, well, Miriam's already gone, and as Aaron's gone, and we've read those words in Psalm 90, Moses is realizing there's another door that is closed. But although he wouldn't get into the promised land and be able to march that great company in there and see things established, he was still going to be gathered to his fathers, gathered to his people, gathered to the presence of the Lord. And thinking about all of this, what has happened with Edomites? Losing his brother? Is he just now going to say, well, it's time for me. I'm going to throw in the towel. I'm going to hand in my resignation. He keeps on going. What a lesson. And when the king of Edom barred the way for Israel, closing that door on them, they were placed on another path. And on that path, they came into contact with another, I'll call it a tribe, another group of people. And this time these folks are Canaanites. So this is going to be a foretaste of what will be ahead under the leadership of Joshua when they go over Jordan. These Canaanites are under the leadership of King Arad. And we read about this the very next event in Numbers 21. And when King Arad the Canaanite, which dwelt in the south, heard tell that Israel came by the way of the spies, then he fought against Israel and took some of them prisoners. So here's a battle. They're immediately thrown into this situation. God has closed one door, another door has opened, and they're stuck straight into a battle situation. And Israel vowed a vow unto the Lord and said, if thou wilt indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. And the Lord hearkened or listened unto the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites. And they utterly destroyed them and their cities. And he called the name of the place Hormah. So what has just happened here? Something strange has happened. Well, it's strange compared to all the other things that Israel has been doing in their time with Moses. Because suddenly, when they're attacked, they decide to have faith. The big, big problem, always attributed to Israel during this period, and most of their history, was that of not believing. And here we find, as soon as they're attacked, as soon as this trouble comes upon them, without any reference it would seem to speaking to Moses, in verse 2, Israel makes a commitment, vows a vow unto the Lord, and says, Lord, if you do this, we'll keep our part. And suddenly they're believing that God can do this, that God can deliver them. And the Lord hears their prayer and answers their prayer in verse 3. So here at this point, with Moses still with them, there's a little foretaste of what the Lord would and could do through them if they began to take possession of the promised land. And it's an encouragement and victory. But a bit like their history, these encouragements and these little glimpses of moments of faith seem to be very short-lived. I wonder, is that our life today? Has our life been fits and starts? Has it been in bursts of enthusiasm and we're just going to call down fire. And then a couple of weeks later, you scan the audience in church, and where are you? And there are people like that. Every fellowship has had them, and places I've been involved in the past, they've all had characters exactly like that. One minute, they were just going on all guns for God, and then the next minute, you had to go running looking for them. And some people, that's their whole life. Because after they've had this victory, something else happens. There's another reason to complain. Verse 4, they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom. So they're still on this big roundabout journey passing the borders of Edom. And the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. And at that discouragement, they did what they did best. They complained. Verse 5. And the people spake against God and against Moses. That's a phrase we've read many times before. Wherever have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water, and our soul loatheth this, the manna. And God does something. The Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. So the same old protest. Don't like this landscape. Don't like the manna. Complain about the water. And their grievance was never really about the lack of basics that I just mentioned here. But their grievance always centered on a real lack of faith in God. And they'd just gone from a situation where they appeared to be showing faith in God, and God gave them a victory, and now, straight away, the next turn, they are back to their old protest. And as we said last week, these are people who, well, there'll be less and less, fewer and fewer of the original ones that came out with Moses of Egypt, who were of an age of accountability. So they had all been thinned out. Almost all of that generation were gone. And yet they had passed on this grumbling and complaining spirit down through to children and children's children. And God has to once again step in with divine chastisement. And the reason is because the other guys that were chastised are dead. And this is a new group. Many of them. Maybe most of them. And they have to see, if it isn't they who are the ones who die, at least they have to see that God is thinning the nation out because of their lack of faith. Now the snakes, who are forever known as being fiery, we're not sure exactly what was meant by that, but one of the best suggestions, I suppose, is that when they bit the people, the wound became inflamed and burned with the poison, and they died maybe a horrific death from the effects of that. But they were classed as fiery serpents. And verse 7 says, therefore the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned. We have spoken against the Lord and against thee. Pray unto the Lord that he would take away the serpents from us. Now what did Moses do? Remember what we just said. He's not going to get into the promised land. He has just lost his brother and his sister. He has had to put up with this all along. In fact, it has been the obstinacy of these people that caused him to be so enraged that it has cost him his place in the new homeland. What would Moses do? What would you do? Moses prayed for the people. But the people were also telling Moses what he should say to the Lord. Ask the Lord to get rid of the snakes for us. Now, this is a judgment from God. Divine chastisement. This is a judgment from God. And they're really saying, we want to be rid of this judgment from God. But God wants to draw something out of them. He wants to give them another opportunity, if you like. He wants to give them a second chance. He wants to see if there would be some response in them at all. And God says to Moses, I want you to make the likeness of one of these snakes and put it on a pole. And as you do so, explain to the people who are suffering from these snake bites that they must look to that snake in order to be completely healed, in order to live, in order to survive. And it would be that look, it would be faith in God's word and God's direction and God's way that would save them. Not God removing the judgment from them. And the result of the judgment was death. Life for a look couldn't be simpler, could it? You know, we read in Isaiah chapter 45 and verse 22, look unto me and be ye saved, all ye ends of the earth, for I am God and there is none else. You go way over to the time of the crucifixion of Jesus, and there he is hanging on the cross, and he's got a thief on either side of him, and one of them starts to notice something different about Jesus. And that thief couldn't turn over a new leaf. He was on the verge of eternity, as was Jesus. He couldn't be christened, he couldn't be confirmed, he couldn't work his way somehow into God's favour. But what he could do was look. And he did. And there was life for him. The very introduction that we have from the one that Jesus said, there was nobody like this man ever before, John the Baptist. And John's introduction of Jesus as the Messiah of Israel is in this way. Behold, look at the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world. It's all about faith in God's remedy. And it's still about that today. When Moses made, verse 9, a serpent of brass, put it on a pole, and it came to pass that if a serpent had bitten any man, when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. Maybe you're sitting there today and you're thinking, I thought in the commandments, God has said, you shall not make any graven image or any likeness of anything, and you shall not bow down to them, and so on. Well, nowhere here, if anybody ever throws that up at you, nowhere here did God say to worship it. Nowhere. In fact, if God had been intending something symbolic to be worshipped, he certainly wouldn't have chosen a snake. Because who do we associate with a snake? The devil. And the fall. In the Garden of Eden. This wasn't about worship, this was about obedience. It symbolized the cause of their death, the curse, if you like, and they had to look and live. Do you know what was said of Jesus when he went to the cross for us? He was made a curse for us. And as we look to him on the cross, we can have life. Now that word that we find, Jehovah or Yahweh Nessai, which is the Lord our standard, the Lord our banner, the Lord our ensign. The Ness in Nessai is translated throughout the Old Testament many times. It's often translated standard or ensign or banner or mast or pole. And we read in Isaiah 11, in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, that means a descendant of the line of David, which shall be for an ensign of the people, and to it shall the Gentiles look. That's you and me. Isn't that a wonderful prophecy? And of course Jesus ties it all together when he speaks about himself. We all know John 3 and 16. Do you know what the previous two verses say? And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, our story, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have eternal life. For God so loved the world. And in case we were in any doubt as to what Jesus meant by lifted up, he then says in John 12 from verse 32, if I be lifted up, will draw all men, not some, all men unto me. This he said, signifying what death he should die. Lifted up on the cross. Made a curse for us. Many centuries later, we read of the brazen serpent again. The actual one. Not somebody referring to this. And it's in the reign of King Hezekiah. And 2 Kings 18 and 4 tells us about how wonderful a king he was. And it says, he, that's King Hezekiah, removed the high places and broke the pillars and cut down the Asherah. And he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days the people of Israel had made offerings unto it. Instead of obeying the commandments, and just looking by faith for that one incident to that thing, you know what? They kept it. And the scripture there implies a long continued referral to that serpent. And yet, in all of those centuries, nobody mentions its existence until the days of Hezekiah. It was a hidden practice. Something tolerated that God wasn't pleased with, but it wasn't talked about. Is there a brass serpent in our lives? Is there something hidden? Something that draws us to disobey the Lord? A hidden thing? And a hindering thing? Well, from the Edomites closing the door to Moses came a chain of events that otherwise might not have happened. Moses, what was it like to have a door close on you? Well, in spite of knowing that the door of the promised land was closed to him, he just kept going on, praying on, praying for the very people who'd cost him his place. And also continuing to see God's hand at work. May the Lord bless these thoughts to your hearts for his name's sake.